Good afternoon again. Hello, hello. Good afternoon. Welcome back for the Saturday afternoon session. And our fifth old timer of the day is my old friend Jim H. from Buckingham. And the first old-timer that made a big impression on Jim was a gentleman called Alan B. And Jim's first meeting was Milton Hall, Manchester. With that, I'll hand you over to Jim. Have we?
Just got a bit out of balance.
Right. Hello, my name's Jim and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
Anything I say is just my own opinion, my own experience based on what's happened to me before and after I came to AA. I feel a genuine old timer. I'm over 80. I've just passed my... Well, I'm well past my 80th birthday. My memory is not good. If I dry up for names and try and remember names that I should know, I hope you forgive me. But my first recollection of my first proper drink, the memory is quite vivid. It was in Gosforth in Newcastle-on-Tyne. It was in the late in 1949. It was at the county hotel in Gosforth. I walked in fear and trembling because I'd never been in a pub before, behind a man with dark black hair and a blue sort of overcoat. Walked up behind him and he ordered a best scotch. Now, I didn't know what a best scotch was. You heathens probably don't know what a best scotch was. A best scotch is a half pint of the cheapest bitter beer that they brew up. So he had a half of best scotch. Peggy, the barmaid, asked what I wanted. A best scotch, 5 pence halfpenny. We were away, and I had this glass of ale and a feeling of euphoria, of goodwill towards men, of an exploding joy, totally overwhelmed me. I've never quite had that sort of feeling again, but I've never forgotten it. I went home, I was a good boy, didn't want to worry my parents. I cleaned my teeth before I went in to see them because I thought, you know, they might smell on my breath. Within 8 months, I was coming home drunk from the pub, picking fights with people, with neighbours in the street, getting into all sorts of arguments and all sorts of trouble. I had my first drunken disorderly when I was 16, still at school, and I don't really need to talk very much about my relationship with alcohol from then on. It was obviously a troubled relationship. Just as time wore on, my memory of my alcoholism is one of fear, of waking up afraid every morning, even if there was nothing, no particular disaster happened. And I can remember I was working as a salesman in Manchester. That would be... In the early 60s, and somehow I fancied a beer, and I went into it, but I hadn't got any money. I just had enough money to scrape up enough for a half pint of Boddington's beer. And if you any of you decide to go back drinking, do not drink Boddington's beer. It is awful, foul, vile, sour stuff. But for some reason, I'd wanted this, and this horrible glass of beer set me off on a craze for alcohol. I had no money. And I went and borrowed money from people that I shouldn't have done. But I had a good session, and then I was very sensible. I left my car in Manchester and walked down. And I was walking down Oxford Street. If any of you know Manchester, you'll walk down Oxford Street. Now, if you turn left, you go to the Oxford Street railway station, which takes you home and to safety, in my case. If you turn right, you turn round to the Yates's Wine Lodge and all sorts of bad places along on the right. You don't want to go there, particularly if you're half pissed the way I was and were just in a position to get home safely. And I was saying, Jim, turn left. Jim, turn left. I went down to the bottom of Ox Street and turned right. Now, if you can't manage your own life to the extent that you can't turn left when you decide to, you're right to be afraid. It's a frightening situation, and there it was. My drinking life was futile. It was full of failure, and it ended about that. It ended on the 21st of August, 1967. There again, I've got a bad memory for dates. I'll never forget that day. I've never felt so ill before or since. I had a friend who was a member of the fellowship. Never seemed particularly relevant, but I went to see him. I went to see him on the Tuesday. The 21st was the Monday. I went to see him on the Tuesday. He told me what we've all been told. It's the first drink that does the damage. He explained it to me vividly. He demonstrated to me with bits of jam and stuff. On the, you know, he showed it as a progression. I won't go through with it now, but I understood. I understood what he was telling me, and I believed what he was telling me. And he arranged for me to go to the meeting, which was on a Saturday, the 26th of August, 1967. Went there, I sat in this room, about this length, but narrow, about half the size of this room, and we were all sort of scrunched up. Chuck came and sat next to me, and he was shivering and shaking. And I got this lovely smell came across. It was, I now know, it was a mixture of rum and hemineverin, a beautiful smell. The chap who was to be my sponsor, who was my sponsor, and this is before a word had been said at this meeting, he said, "Don't you worry about Billy, he's back off a suicide attempt, he's totally harmless, but he will shake and rattle and roll a bit." And I looked at this bloke, and I was not a caring person. I was not in a caring mood. I was in the shit, not very happy about it. I looked at this bloke, and I thought, "You poor sod, I know exactly how you feel." Now, that was not Jim. That was not the way I reacted to people. But that sort of compassion, that sort of rapport was there before anybody said a word. Then they kicked off the meeting. The chap in the chair was a bloke called Stan from Ashton. Now, you know, they say, "Oh, listen to the similarity and not the differences." This bloke was totally different to me. He used to drink bottles of Long John whiskey. He'd been put into the Parkside Mental Hospital on a section for a year. He'd had 34 sessions of electric shock treatment, at the end of which he'd forgotten his name. The only thing he hadn't forgotten was that he wanted a drink. And I was listening to this, and I thought, bloody hell, you know, if they can't fix him, how the hell are they going to fix a wimp like me? And I was totally confused. I was totally impressed. I felt that I'd come into a very special place. I thought it was a bit too good for me, but it was a special place. Sat down after the meeting, and they were talking about Jack called Dr. James. Dr. James was not a doctor. He was a lecturer in chemistry at the local university. Apparently a very brilliant man, an alcoholic. But he had a theory that you could brew all the harmful chemicals out of some sort of alcoholic beverage to make it totally harmless to alcoholics. So, his theory was that it's not the alcohol that did for alcoholics, it was the bad chemicals in the brewery, you know. So that's interesting. Where can I meet him? You know, what meeting did he go? Oh, no, he's dead. So I thought, well, nobody's going to fix me, and I can't even think my way out of this, you know, because cleverer men than me have tried. And I did go along with AA. I went to my meetings. I said, at the second meeting I went to, there was a lady called Nora who wanted me to give her lifts to meetings. And she said, you can borrow my big book, but I want you to give me lifts. So I read the book. She said, you will hear from the men and women you hear in these meetings, you will hear their personal experience. This is the message, you should read it. And in all fairness, I did read it. So in my first few weeks, I read the big book. And I went to a lot of meetings. And my own personal opinion is that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a book for beginners. The time to read it, the time to get into it, is straight away. Now, I understood. I read it all. I understood every word. I didn't accept every word. In fact, there was some of that. I'm not doing that. But some of the rest sounds okay. So I'd started on a journey. Who was an old timer who impressed me? Alan B. I've got it down here. There he is, Alan B.
Yep.
Now, this is Christmas of 1967. I don't know that AA is looked at in a very particularly benign or respectful way even today. In 1967, it was looked at a lot less benignly and a lot less respectfully than it is now. For that reason, the sort of village elders of AA, the sort of more senior types, felt that nothing but the best was good enough for AA. So we had our Christmas dinner in the Midland Hotel in Manchester in black suits and bow ties. So there we were. And I was sitting there, and even then, you know, that wasn't quite my thing, but I was sitting there with my wife. She came down with me. And they were giving a thank you dinner to this Alan B. Now, Alan B lived in Birmingham. Alan B did the 12-step work for Manchester before there were any groups in Manchester. So he had a phone call to go and call on some alcoholic, some blithering alcoholic in Manchester. He got in his car and drove from Birmingham to Manchester. Bearing in mind, there's no M1 or in M6 in those days. He came across the Pennines, called on whoever he was calling on, and some of them got sober and started off AA in Manchester. And I looked at this bloke and I thought, you must be bloody mad, mate. You must be crackers. But he looked well on it. And they were talking at this meeting about the legacy of service and the steps under traditions, you know, of recovery and of unity and service. And the fact that there was a human being there who'd actually done this stuff, who'd done something, obviously, for the people in this room, brought that idea of a legacy back to me. And then all I can say is that I was willing to help these people carry the message as and when I was asked. And funnily enough, I was sitting down. I do love my international rugby. I haven't missed watching many games. And this would be a few weeks later, a couple of months later maybe, it was the England-Wales ready to kick off. The five nations, as it was then, it was all ready to get off. The phone went, would I go out and do a 12-step call? And very reluctantly, I thought, well, people have done more than this, you know, for us. And so I got involved with going out. There was a lot more going out in those days, wasn't there? You know, mm-hmm. I suppose they thought I wasn't really experienced enough to do much sort of step 12 step work, but I was like a sort of gopher, you know. You know what a gopher is? It's somebody you tell them to go for this and go for that. And the things that I was go up, that there weren't a lot of women in AA at the time. And they must have considered me to be safe, which isn't very flattering, but if they had a woman alcoholic up in Parkside Mental Hospital. And these girls said, "Jim, go up and get her. We haven't got time to get her. You're not 12-stepping her. You've no need to engage with her in any way. Just hold on to a knicker elastic. Don't let her run away. Bring her to the meeting and take her back. And, you know, and if you get her back safely to a ward, that's your job done." So it was that sort of stuff. And I was impressed by the people I met. I mean, John was talking about Sackville this morning. My friend Gordon, who helped me a lot of these blokes were people who'd been born at the turn of the 20th century and in the early days of the 20th century. So they were a bit different, not very emotionally sort of mature or capable, but very strong, very solid. Gordon was a great man. He'd been a major in the Cameron Southern Highlanders. He was a leader of men, and he helped me a lot. And I would do things for these people. I'm a bit like Terry, you know. I know it's wrong, really. You know, it says, you know, it's principles above personalities. I was very impressed by the personalities. In all honesty, I was willing to go around in my car and do jobs for these people because I felt that I was walking in the footsteps of giants. These were very, very capable, very, very powerful people in their personalities and in their ambitions and in what they could achieve. So they said go to the intergroup meetings. And I really had no sort of propensity, no sort of desire to be involved in committee work or anything. I'm not that type of person. But I went down to an intergroup meeting, and these great people were quarrelling like children. And I sat there, and I just couldn't. This is not me, not what I would normally do. I put my hand up and said, "Look, I'm very sorry. But, you know, you've shown me that the traditions, and the first tradition says that recovery in this fellowship depends on AA unity. This sort of talk that's going on here, I find it threatening. I don't like it." Bang. They all shut up. Got on with their sort of meeting. The only trouble was, after it, another guy, Bill S., who was the secretary of the first Manchester meeting, came across and said, "Look, we want you to be a treasurer in the intergroup." You know, so all of a sudden I was on. I was on a committee. And you know, I just have to hold my hands up and apologise. I spent the next 20 years on committees in AA. And it was probably the saving up, but that's another story. I had a friend. Sometimes I'll use surnames of people, and if I use that, you can know that they're dead, and they wouldn't have minded anyhow me using their surnames. But Dave Smith was joined about the same time as me, and he's a lot more observant than me. And Bill used to come to the meeting. He used to take the Manchester meeting on a Wednesday, first Manchester group, and he said, "Look, have you seen that bloke's car?" I said, "I don't look at people's car. What do you mean?" He says, "Well, he's been coming to work He's come to the meeting in a bloody great Mercedes all the time we've known him, and he's in a Morris Minor. And what interested Dave in that was that the man's circumstances had changed, but what he did at meetings and the way he behaved and his total demeanour never changed one iota. What, in fact, had happened was that Bill had been the owner of, I think it was an electrical wholesaler's business, and he went bust. And he moved off to the south of England, and that really was the sort of end of it, so far as I was concerned, except that they were talking earlier on about the... You were speaking about 1974 conference. You know, I was at that one, and I used to go to the conference, and then I used to meet some of the guys, Ronald H. and a whole number of guys whose names I've forgotten, who were really involved in trying to build up the strength of the fellowship, the resources of the fellowship, and the services of the fellowship. They were trying to do all that, and they were doing it against quite a bit of opposition, because some people didn't really, they wanted to do their own things. And in fact, the first, I can't remember what the first conference I went to, but it was a bloody quarrelsome one. And I remember Bill sort of coming up to me before me. He said, "Don't worry about what happens." He says, you might get a bit upset and disturbed by some of the things that are said, but don't worry. Common sense and AA principles will win out in the end. So I really had a sort of rapport with these people, an admiration for them. I was willing to help them, and so I became a sort of gopher for some of these blokes down in London, as well as for Gordon and his mates locally. And started to know them, and you know, they were remarkable people. And the thing about it is, I've forgotten a lot of their names, and they wouldn't mind that that we'd forgotten their names, or we never know. You will never know what they did. Sometimes they didn't let go all that easily, but the anonymity, that they were not looking for anything for themselves. There was a little bloke who was the treasurer of AA, and he did a hell of a lot to sort of repair the finances of the fellowship. He put money in local authority bonds, which were paying about 17% or something like that. You know, but they're just brilliant people. Gordon became chairman of the board. Bill was the general secretary. I was running around helping them on the executive committee, and I was their gopher down there even then, if they're bits and pieces of trouble. They didn't seem, you see, they didn't just sort of sit up on high and sort of say, this is how it's going to be. They had their representatives. They didn't tell people what to say, but they had people representing them. Wherever there was trouble, a bit of trouble, they had somebody there who was just sort of trying to speak common sense, and it was a very, very successful regime of very strong-minded people, and they built a structure for this fellowship in England, Wales, and Scotland, which has survived to today. It was very controversial. Nobody thanked them for it, but it has stood down and has allowed us to communicate and to carry the message in an effective way. And I suppose, really, I can just talk to you a little bit about some of the things that happened more locally in Manchester. We hadn't got a telephone service. When I phoned AA, in the first instance, the Samaritans were running the phone number for Alcoholics Anonymous in Manchester. And we felt that we should have our own phone. And it wasn't really, not everybody agrees. They thought it was too ambitious. And we moved our meetings, a number of us in Manchester, to Hewett Street, 4A Hewett Street in Manchester, which was too big for us, really. But we put our phone there. We had meetings there most nights of the week. And we had a little, and this is what was our downfall, not such a little, quite a big sort of lounge where people could sit around, you know, during the day and have a cup of coffee, honesty boxes and all that sort of thing. It was brilliantly successful for a while. The huge enthusiasm went into it. We even took more space and took a huge meeting room, bigger than this one, and with because we had local carpenters and roofers and God knows what, with mezzanine roofs and all sorts of things, and lights in laid into the walls and all this sort of thing. I remember we had our first public meeting, and the sort of local probation officers and that sort of thing were coming into this room and looking around, and they said, "These people are rich, you know." But really, what we found was that AA traditions, if you're sort of running a sort of lounge for alcoholics to sit in, the traditions don't really fit in there. You know, we thought people could sit down and recover. They were sitting down and sort of starting off romances and fights and feuds and God knows what. And it did go down. The reason that I tell this story is that we were aware of the conditions that we were undertaking. We were aware of what the tradition said. We tried to bend the traditions to accommodate what we were doing, and the outcome was a total disaster. Within a year, this sort of salubrious place, the door that we let people into was shut. It had like a sort of little door that they have in clubs, like shebeens, so you can see who's there. Oh yes, you can come in. You know, there were people suffer because of that. People came to AA who would have been better off not coming. And it ended in total failure. And of course, we learned from our lesson and just moved into a sensible sort of premises. But that was a painful sort of slot. But there were good things. There were good people, and I still meet in London and places like that people who started off their AA careers in Hewett Street. And we're getting down a bit nearer the present day. I'm just telling you about things that happened. I mean, we went. I bet you were there. I'm not sure if the convention was held at the Grand Hotel in Brighton or the Metropole, but a hell of a lot of us stayed at the Grand Hotel in Brighton. And we had a lovely convention. 2 or 3 weeks later, the IRA came down and bombed the place to smithereens while the government were in there. Now, I was down in the office the week after all this happened, and the police came in, and they had a photograph of the man. This would be 4 or 5 days after it all happened. They had a photograph of the man who was eventually convicted about 18 months later for this crime. I said, "Did you see him there?" "No." He said, "Okay." You wouldn't believe it. This bloke who did the bombing or who got convicted for it had booked in under the name of Barry Walsh. Do you know anybody called Barry Walsh? So the police descended on Barry, an innocent dentist there in Oxford. He thought it was a hell of a joke. But again, it just, you know, some of the stuff that's written in AA that we don't read very much, the top 12 concepts of world service and that sort of thing, you know, all this sort of detail of how we're built in. The principle is that we're part of the community, that we are built into part of the community, and we're established as our own sort of institution where it's part of the community of this country. So the police said, we want the names and addresses of all the Irish people, your visitors from Ireland, at this convention. There were 49 of them. And we gave it to them because we're not above the law. It was our job. We gave all these names and addresses to the police, and not one complained, not one person complained. So that was a little, and also around about the same time. See, when I joined in 1967, as I say, everybody took the piss out of AA in those days. So, and that was why the members that I knew were so dogmatic about, you know, this is the way to go. You know, if you take a drink, you know, the younger people like Dave Smith and I used to laugh at it because they'd say, you will end up dead or in a lunatic asylum or in an early grave. You know, we used to imitate them. But you know, they used to hammer it, huh? I mean, there's a guy called Tom G, who was secretary of a group in they met on a Tuesday at Holeswood Hall. And he used to stand up. He was an immaculate man. He had his blue suit on, tie, everything sort of absolutely perfect, except that he had bad feet. He had sore feet, so he was wearing plimsolls on his feet. But he used to stand up and sort of really hammer that, you know, it's the first drink that does the damage. If you're like me, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, if you don't believe me, ask them. Now, for some reason, up in the far corner of the room, anybody who'd had a slip the week before would congregate. Ask them, the great experimenters. You know? And he wasn't a great one for romance in AA, you know, boy meets girl sort of thing. He has some expression about the red-headed woman walks in or something like that. I don't know. But he was not acceptable, really. But because he was sort of banging out this message, but we all came down and listened to him. It was the most popular group in Manchester. Because we and then it got so busy that they used to split the group in half, and some would go off with Tom, and some would go off with a sensible AA member, you know, who'd run a proper meeting. And the ones that went there had a big resentment because they'd missed their weekly bollocking. You know? So really, that was the atmosphere. And all of a sudden, the news came down that the AA had been registered as a charity. Now, to us, that was huge. You know, that was recognition. That was fine, and so time went on, you know, and we were a charity, you know, we had certain concessions made to us, and then it gradually dawned on us, and this is as I was sort of becoming involved in the central services, that really that wasn't all that smart a move, because if you were a charity, you weren't allowed to refuse contributions from anywhere or anybody. Now, at first, that didn't seem to matter because it was going to give us any money. Round about the mid-80s, Shell BP, Uncle Tom Cobley and all started sending us in loads of money. You would have thought that if we said, no, keep your bloody money, you know, they would have been pleased. They weren't. They went and complained to the Charity Commission, charity commissioners, and we're in a lot of trouble. One of the things that AA should be grateful for, probably not even aware of a lot of the time, is that there are non-alcoholic members of the General Service Board who would come on and advise and things like that. And mainly, as you could imagine, these are guardian reading types. You know, we had the We had the sort of chairman of ASH, you know, the organisation was trying to stop people smoking and all this sort of thing, and all these types. And by some mistake, a guy was recommended to us. He's Judge Edward Wood. Now, nobody, you can't sack a judge, apparently. This guy came very close to being sacked. In fact, he was got rid of. He told a jury with a coloured man in the dock, you've got plenty of evidence about this case, make your mind up and I'll give you 20 minutes to do it. Well, you know, that was the end. You know, he retired, you know, so he was really not the sort of type that one would have thought would come on to a board like ours. But somehow or other, by some mistake, by some act of God, he did. And it's just as well he did, because he came in right in the middle of all this trouble with the charity commissioners. And he was a funny man. He loved AA. I mean, he was, from the previous century. He wasn't from the 20th century, he's from the 19th century. And with all the attitudes of that, but he said, look, lads, you know, you've got to act fast. Get the best lawyer you can. Set up a meeting with all these people. So we did. We had our lawyer, who was charging us at least, I think, in excess of £1,000 an hour, and this is in the mid-1980s, and he was sitting there. He chaired the meeting. We had the charity commissioners, the secretary to the attorney general, all sorts of people around. And they said, well, look, you're just not complying with what you should do. You've been a charity. You've got to accept this money. If you don't, all the benefits you've had of being a charity since 1967 has got to be paid back. And also, it will also involve your groups, because they have had contributions as well. And Jack Gow, God bless him, our general secretary, said, "Well, you'll just have to do what you can do. We can't accept this money. It's our unity, our whole existence depends on it. Take the money. Our members will understand." Now, I agreed with every word that he said, except that I didn't think that our members would understand. Edward Wood then sits forward and says, "Look, these are good people. You've got to do something here." And they came around with an arrangement in the end, where Alcoholics Anonymous is the only charity which can refuse donations, and it's siphoned off to something, I think it's connected with alcohol concern, but I'm not sure about that. But that was just a sort of little incident of somehow that God looks after us. And now we're coming on to stuff where we've got witnesses here, so I better be careful. You know, there could be a difference of recollection. You see, funnily enough, these old boys that was the sort of our forerunners, the people that helped me and who impressed me, they knew. I mean, people like Robin Jay in Oxford, Peter F. down in Kent, they had people like that who were their gophers. Well, they had people going out, you know, sort of helping them, so they weren't just sort of sitting up in their office. Also, intergroup chairman, strong intergroup chairman, like this fella here, trying to think of others, you know, there must be a lot of them. But these people, if they didn't know them, they'd be on their radar. So, the Chiltern and Thames intergroup would have been a model for the sort of intergroup they wanted. They wanted good order, almost good military discipline. They wanted things to work. They didn't want a lot of waffle. They wanted services to be improved. They wanted work to be done. They didn't care sort of what was said at the meeting so much as what was done between the meetings. This was what they were looking at. But they sort of got a bit off a bit more than they could chew with the Chiltern Tanzing degree, because that area, which had a lot to do with that particular intergroup, thought that we weren't organising our finances in a sensible way. And I had a meeting with yourself, Danny.
Yes.
In some dump in Tame, I think. Well, in Trent.
Was it a dump in Tame?
Yeah, your dump.
Oh, my dump.
And it was a fairly acrimonious sort of discussion. And this is really sort of the theme of my recollection of AA. People's human failings, human fallibilities in this fellowship can be redeemed by generosity of spirit and the power of this fellowship. So I knew what they were saying wasn't entirely wrong. In fact, it was probably entirely right. So I said, look, we'll see what we can do. And we sort of, put things into movement, and they said, well, we'll try and organise a sort of special collection to deal with your problems now. And they did. They started a gratitude week, then they had their gratitude week in Chiltern Tanzing Intergroup. Other intergroups took it up, and within a year it was done within the whole fellowship. It was a huge shift in bringing resources into the centre, to the central services, and it also gave awareness, got people thinking about, oh yeah, maybe we've got a bit of money and maybe we should send it up. You know, it's an issue. It sort of put it on people's radar, I suppose. And so Terry and Danny went off slightly mollified, but they started something which was huge. So this is just my experience of how this fellowship can work. And I mean, there was that other I'll probably finish with this, but there was, do you remember when we had a big convention at Blackpool? It was an anniversary. What anniversary? Was it?
Yeah.
50th anniversary of AA. So, who was it? Big Pat was running it, and he got us in, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, whether to help or provide a bit of management muscle or I don't know. But it obviously, for a special anniversary, he wanted to do special stuff. So let's have a meeting on the beach and all this sort of thing. But people, the General Service Board, and really me, and they were saying, really? Blackpool in June, July? You know, can you guarantee the weather and all this sort of thing? So we had our meeting. And then all of a sudden I was given a job. I was the treasurer. I was running a paint wholesaler's outfit at the time. I brought up five 15-litre drums. To put the money in. So that was that. And we had this sort of meeting on the beach, and it was cold, it was windy, and everybody had disappeared early. And I mean, you could have put the collection in a kid's pot. You know, the sort of thing that makes sandcastles with. You could have got it. We were up the creek without a paddle. So, again, it wasn't all sweetness and light, you know. Oh, Jim, if you'd put yourself around a bit more and got some more money, what a bloody stupid idea you lot have had, you know, and all this sort of thing. So it was a bit toing and froing. But to cut a long story short, Terry chaired the final meeting, and he pulled out all the stops on the finance. The sun was shining, and I had a big team, you know, a lot from Amersham, Brian from Amersham and people like that. Herbie was special. He was security. He wasn't collecting money, but Brian and these lot were going around with my 15-litre drums. I don't know if anybody knows what a 15-litre drum is, but it's about that size of the table and about that deep. Now, as we were walking away from the convention, I found 5 15-litre drums full of money. Full of money. The only problem is, how the hell were we going to get it back to the Winter Gardens in Blackpool? We were on the beach. Rick had his old car there.
Yeah.
There was Mick the Roofer to provide a bit of muscle to carry this stuff because it was heavy. Herbie and me, I think. Now, Herbie was security. I said, you have got to be there to see that nobody takes it off us. So anyhow, we got down to outside the Winter Gardens. Herbie's jacket slips off. He's got a chain with spikes on wrapped around his arm. Not really very hair. I said, lads, can you carry this? Because I'm not even going to try. Yes, Jim, we can do it. They carried it for about 5 yards and then stopped, you know. They sort of manhandled this all the way up to some back office in the Winter Gardens where Jim, the General Secretary of AA, and the Treasurer, whose name escapes me, were waiting. And this Treasurer had been so worried. When she saw this money, she burst into tears. So that was it, you know, sort of, we didn't get it right, I didn't get it right, but it redeemed itself in the end, and it was a good convention, people going away saying best ever, you know, and everybody was happy. So that is my experience of the fellowship. Honestly, unwillingly, and without any spark of ambition, I've sort of been involved in sort of group decisions, group discussions. Now, in most groups like that, the job is to come to a decision. In this fellowship, you need to take a bit more time because the task is to come to an agreement so that most people can agree. And this is what I've seen happen. Somebody was speaking about, you know, some people who knew Bill W. On two occasions, I met a guy called Bob Pearson who knew Bill W. well, and he was the general manager of the AA service office in New York. Now, there are two things about that Bob Pearson said. He didn't offer much opinion, but he didn't like our leaflet, Who Me, which was the first one that a lot of us saw. I don't know if it's still in existence. But he said, no, in AA, we don't tell people if they're an alcoholic or not. We don't sort of diagnose, all this sort of thing. Didn't like it. So... We sort of took that on board and thought we'll change this, or well, maybe we'll have to discontinue it. Now, Barry Walsh, who was quite amused when he was told that he was under suspicion for bombing the Grand Hotel, was not amused when he was told that we were stopping Who Me. In fact, he went totally apeshit, and so did everybody. See, Who Me was the first leaf that a lot of us had been had, you know, it was held in great affection. So we had to try and sort of rewrite it, and we it was actually Robin Jenkinson's girlfriend, who was a journalist with the Daily Mail, had a go at it. But she didn't like the fact that there was a committee picking it to pieces afterwards. So, my God, now I've forgotten her name. She did the chair at Brackley the other day, a lady from Deddington, used to be Banbury, used to be a journalist, used to write travel books. Anyhow, this lady who shall be... Sylvie.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Sylvie rewrote this, and with great charm and tact, sweethearted the literature committee into accepting it. That was not a job without... that didn't require talent and sort of a lot of people's skills as well. And she put it right, and she produced our Humi. But this Bob Pearson said to me on one occasion, Bill W. would have thought that he had a sponsor. So whilst he was the first member of the fellowship, he was sponsored into this fellowship by other people who told him that they had found that they were not capable of finding sobriety from their own resources, that they found that what they had to have was a transforming experience of the spirit, which could be brought about by taking certain steps. And in a way, as he said to me, he said, that's a very bold statement. It's not that it may or you may be lucky, if there's an R in the month or something like that. If you take certain steps, you will have a transforming experience of the spirit, which can change your life. And he said, that is the message. That is the message that we should be passing. And that gets back to the lady I told you about, Nora, who gave me the book and said, this is the message. You see, if I was talking to you, if you were new people in the fellowship, I would be saying, if you're like me, you will never drink again. If you're like me, today is Grand National Day, you've got as much chance of drinking without disaster as you have of finally the next 20 five winners of the Grand National. They're impossible odds. If you're like me, you've got as much chance of drinking alcohol without total disaster as you have of levitating in this room and flying around the room and going back to your seat. Now, that's my message. The AA message is, you need never drink again. So that's it, really. I've had a good life in AA. I've been lucky in AA. I'm enormously grateful to AA. I was lost, and I've had a large chunk of my life where I've been able to behave like a semi-reasonable human being. And really, I'm privileged to have had the chance to just pass this experience on to you for what it's worth. Thanks very much for listening to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim. Selfishly, I loved hearing about the wild pioneering days. They were the Wild West, trust me. They really were. Good fun. A bit bloody at times, but all part of the fun. And you referred at one stage to AA and recovery being viewed less benignly than it may be today. And by God, that is true. The courage of those people all those years ago, and I'm not talking about what I call the new breed of old times, I'm talking about the originals. You know, in those days, there were still music hall acts going around, and their whole act was being drunk. Falling about being a drunk. And there was a lot of misconception about us and a lot of hostility from the medical profession and various other places. It took real balls, real courage to be a member of AA. particularly if you're in service and therefore your profile was higher. And I think of them as pioneers, and they had an amazing journey, but by God, they had guts and courage. Today, I beg slightly to differ, it's quite fashionable in some quarters to be in recovery. I'm told if you're an actor, go to meetings in Los Angeles, you'll get a job. The 12-step program, but in those days that most certainly was not the case. Absolutely not. And anonymity for many was precious. It had to be. And some of them had jobs where it would have counted against them. So, great to the boys. You and I have had some good laughs and a few battles over the time. I remember Gordon and Bill with great respect and affection. They were great, great men. It's good to hear their names.